Say, do you have a chance to look at this?
The Environment, Economic Development, and Agricultural Division for Monday, February 25th, 2013 will come to order. We're going to continue with our budget overviews today, and the DNR is going to be finishing up their presentation. Labor Industry and then Board of Water and Soil Resources will be third. Hopefully we can get these done. Wednesday we'll be having some bonding projects, some bills coming in here, and reviewing bonding projects. If any of you have bonding projects that are in this division, please make sure you let Scott know that you want to have a hearing, if you do want to have a hearing, because we will eventually be making some type of a recommendation to the full bonding committee, and they'll be going over it and deciding what to put in their bill. I haven't figured out if we're having a bill yet this year, but it would be nice to be ready for it just in case. So let's get started here. Who wants to go first here?
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, Meyer. Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources, Government Relations Director. Today we have Parks and Trails Division, Fish and Wildlife, and Division of Enforcement to run through on our budget proposals with you all. Today with me, I have Cortland Nelson.
Excuse me, Mr. Meyer, we do have a quorum. Senator Osmek is now on Senate time. I'm very, very, very proud of him. and I do want to point out that Hibbing Chisholm did beat West Tonka, I believe, in the consolation final of the girls' hockey tournament.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, for reminding me of that. Next
okay.
year.
Okay, Mr. Meyer, you may want to start over.
It's been a rough week for West Tonka.
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, again, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. We have three divisions remaining in our budget presentation. You all should have the packet of slides within your folders. We're going to start off with Parks and Trails and Director Cortland Nelson, go into Fish and Wildlife with Director Ed Bogus, and then finish up with Director Colonel Jim Conrad from our Enforcement Division. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to turn it over to Cortland Nelson.
Mr. Nelson, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members, Cortland Nelson, DNR Director of Parks and Trails. Thank you for the opportunity to address you today. I thought I just would take a minute to go over some of our division, because some of you may not be aware of all that we do, and I think it's important to note that. All of you are familiar with our state park system, of which we have 76 state parks and state recreation areas, and our state trail system, of which we have 25 throughout the state. But we also manage and operate 1,500 of the 3,000 water access sites that are around the state. We benefit most of your communities in the state through our large grant program. Money comes to us through a variety of sources and goes out for motorized and non-motorized trail activities and water improvement, water access grants. A lot of structures in our system. I believe Commissioner Landwehr mentioned we have 2,600 buildings in DNR. 1,600 of those 2,600 are in state parks. And we have a large impact economically on the state of Minnesota also as part of our mission. So we're a varied state agency, state division that has many tentacles positive, we hope, throughout the whole state. Moving on to the presentation, you can see with the handout there, our primary drivers are summarized in terms of the recreational activity as well as the natural resource and local economic activities. Our statistics that we use from the University of Minnesota Research, which I'll mention again in a few minutes, indicates that we generate about $280 million in local benefits from our park system, and about half of that from our state trail system. So at another time, Mr. Chairman, I can go over those in greater detail should you have the interest. Whoop, went too fast. As you have seen from the other divisions, this is a bar graph of our funding scheme that we have within the division. Similar to most of the other divisions, you will see the natural resource funds, the special revenue accounts, they're called different names in different divisions. We have a little bit of game and fish fund that are really targeted to some of our water-based activities, the environmental trust fund, And then, dissimilar from the other divisions, we receive for our grant program and also for our division the legacy dollars that come to us. And so I want to just make sure you understand the meaning of that. We receive legacy dollars for the activities in our Parks and Trails division. We also receive the grant monies that goes through us to Greater Minnesota. So we wear two hats in that situation. Part of it benefits our system, and then part of it is the grants administration that we provide for Parks and Trails grants throughout Greater Minnesota. We also have had support this last biennium for one-time money to help us with our operational expenditures from the Environmental Trust Fund. And as we will get to here in a couple of minutes, we also are greatly concerned about the overall decline at the bottom of the chart with our general fund dollars over time. And again, you have heard this from a couple of the other divisions, and we are in that same similar situation. I would finally mention that we receive in that natural resource account, the purple bars in the middle, those are all of the accounts that come from special user funds and fees. So that entails the snowmobile account, that entails the off-highway vehicle account. We get revenues from our own sources of our camping and day use activities that goes into a sub fund of those natural resource accounts. And they are very targeted in terms of what can be the expenditures coming out of those. And at another point, if you'd like to have a clearer and deeper explanation of those natural resource accounts, we've got that information and would be glad to explain that in greater detail. So that's the overall picture of our funds. Let's see here. This is a pie chart of the governor's recommendation, and again, at very general numbers for the biennium. We have had a decrease in our general fund over the last few years that has been supplanted one time with the Environmental Trust Fund dollars, as I mentioned before. We were very appreciative of that. There is a recommendation in the governor's budget to basically replace that with some new general fund dollars that I'll cover here in a minute or two. We also have had some slight decreases in our federal dollars. We do not get a lot of federal dollars as opposed to some of the other divisions, but we have had a small decrease in that. Also, I would want to mention, anticipating one of your questions, that in the Parks and Trails Fund, the light purple piece of pie there, that those are the legacy dollars. And so those include both the grant monies that I referred to earlier as well as the dollars that we receive for our own system. And in the governor's recommendation, there is a $15.9 million recommendation for the Division of Parks and Trails portion of that, and a little bit more in the next year based on the anticipated growth of the fund. And then in the grants section, $7.9 million for 2014, and then a small increase for 2015. And this would be the arena of discussions that will likely come up about the dispersal of those legacy dollars and the report that has been referred to by Commissioner Landwehr with regards to the recommendations from a special committee that you have received the report on about the distribution of those legacy dollars. So that light purple piece of the pie is our section as represented in the governor's recommendation about that.
Excuse me, Mr. Nelson. Senator Saxock.
Yes, Mr. Nelson, Director Nelson, maybe I should ask you this earlier, but I'm kind of trying to get a scope what is a great parks and trails system. In the last 10 years, What type of increases in numbers of parks and numbers of trails have we seen?
Mr. Chairman, members, the state trails portion has had a couple of state trails authorized and that are at a near completion level, the closest to mine being the Browns Creek segment of the Gateway Trail that's heading to Stillwater. We have had, in addition, four state parks and recreation areas in the last 10 years that have been created. Lake Vermilion, Big Bog up at Red Lake, let's see, down around Litchfield, Greenleaf State Recreation Area.
And Lake LaSalle.
Pardon me?
Lake LaSalle.
And Lake LaSalle. Thank you, Bob. So there are four that have been added in the last 10 years to that list on the state park side.
That memory thing gets worse as you get older. Senator Saxon.
And Mr. Chair and Director Nelson, so with what you just told me there and looking at your, the funding expenditures by fund, how do we go about increasing the numbers of trails and parks and our general fund or in the funds that we use to maintain these? I mean, how do we measure that?
Mr. Chairman, members, Senator, the history up until the last 10 years was that when a new state park was created, there would be an appropriation that would come with that, and then that would be the base budget that they would operate on. The revenues now go back to us in a circuitous route. You appropriate those dollars back to us. So in the case of Big Bog, for instance, which I'm familiar with, there was an expected and pretty accurate number with regards to the revenues that were going to be coming. There was some small general fund support, and then there were other natural resource account dollars because it was a water-based park that we could use for some of the operational and development costs. So that's an example where it all kind of worked. Recently, and particularly this is one of the issues that we are going to be facing soon, with Lake LaSalle and with Lake Vermilion, with Browns Creek, we are using legacy dollars for the modest operational costs such as they are right now. But that is one of the challenges that we're going to have, Senator, moving forward, particularly with Lake Vermilion as that comes online. We will be receiving some revenues, but that upfront operational cost right now, to answer your question, is being borne by the legacy fund.
So as long as you brought it up, when do you anticipate Vermilion coming online?
Mr. Chairman, we will be building a campground next summer. Hope to have it done by next fall. We'll be doing the water, power, and roads, first phase of water, power, roads. We have done some day use areas, so we will be operational by next summer. For those of you who are not aware, we're in the very fortuitous situation to have Lake Vermilion actually border Sudan Underground Mine State Park. So, Mr. Chairman, we avoid some of those startup costs that we might ordinarily have if we were developing a new state park in another area and we didn't have that kind of support. But next year will be our big capital development first phase effort, and we're excited about that.
Are we going to finish developing Sudan also as long as we're there?
Mr. Chairman, that is a part of the phase two discussions that we're having right now.
Phase two. Okay, Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up on Senator Saxon's comment, so if we've added these four new parks, which is fine, do we then anticipate that there'll be any closures of state parks or reductions of existing state parks?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, we have reduced a number of our operational costs over the last couple of years, and so it is both a cost containment exercise as well as trying to stretch our management, our information technology, and our administrative efforts. There comes a point of, diminishing returns is not the right phrase, but there becomes a point where we will soon have to be making some downsizing efforts in the absence of some new revenues.
Let's take Senator Sparks' comment one step further. It seems like I saw a number like $100 million worth of maintenance costs in our state parks. that is needed. Are we addressing that in this budget or in the bonding bill or in the future?
Mr. Chairman, not in this budget directly, other than that some of the legacy projects that we have listed. We certainly will make recommendations and requests in bonding opportunities, and it's a part of our all of our discussions about funding sources that we're getting, taking care of that big, big backlog of it's both rehab for a system that has 80-year-old units as well as developing those new opportunities like Lake Vermilion. So we have a priority list, and it is got a bunch of zeros at the end of it. We're very aware of that difficult situation and hoping to maneuver our way through that as successfully as we can.
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, to the issue of the state parks, Vermilion specifically, I wasn't aware of Sudan Mining, you said, was state park, was right next door. When you say next door, are you saying they're adjacent, 2 miles away, 20 miles away? How close? And at some point, I'll just second part of the question, do we bring on these new ones and then worry about, are we going to bring close some down in the late, in the future, or is there some already on the target list that are lowly used, or how do you go about that?
Mr. Chairman, members, to your first question, Sudan Underground Mine State Park is the western neighbor by border to Lake Vermilion. It's about, I want to say, 1,600 acres, and Lake Vermilion is 3,000, and they share a common border. So we were very fortuitous with that that purchase in that sense. To the larger issue, as I said, Senator, we are constantly making adjustments to our management. We have developed a matrix of looking at our state parks and recreation areas from a point of view of natural resource value, from usership, options for partners, options for seasonal operations, and any number of related issues as we look into that system analysis, trying to find the best way to disperse our revenues and to provide the best service for the most people that we can. So we are actively engaged in that particular activity.
So, Mr. Chair, Lake Vermilion, do we have projections? I mean, is Sudan undermining state park at capacity? And maybe this isn't the right one. I mean, is there going to be a problem where Lake Vermilion now pulls from Sudan, or are we going to pull from others? And or do you just go ahead with opening all four of them, and then we worry about closing others later?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, those happen at the same time in terms of being aware of our financial challenges. And I'm not trying to be too subjective with the answer, but as we know, for instance, that Lake Vermilion is going to be coming online, we have done some projections based on actual counts at other parks in Northeast Minnesota. So we have a pretty good idea of what the visitation will be there. There is an expense component with an operation like Sudan that really cannot be diminished because of the nature of that experience. We take people underground and have a fairly solid set of costs in providing that operation. What we hope to do, Senator, is actually bring more visitation to Sudan with the adjacent state parks. The other part of your question, if I am interpreting it correctly, is that as we move forward, your budget processes direct us to make decisions about where our resources are allocated, and so we have to make those decisions in advance. Most of them at this level are about where full-time employees are at, and to a lesser degree, the costs associated with the operation of some of our state parks and state recreation areas. When a vacancy occurs, we analyze, do we need to fill that position? Parenthetically, I would tell you over the last 2 years, we have eliminated 20 full-time positions in state parks, and all of these have been under the guise of good management, efficient management, and cost containment. In the Lake Vermilion area, Senator, I'm sure we will be looking at what kind of a management structure we need to have, what we can do in the off-season to make better use of our people and our resources, and to manage more efficiently around that. Does that help answer that question, Senator?
Well, it does, and Mr. Chair, maybe I'll just where I'm a little concerned or is that we add more assets. I know years ago, a state park in my district, Glacial Lake State Park, Hope County, near Starbuck and Glenwood, was on a list to be closed or reduced back significantly for camping. And I'm just wondering if there's a list of those parks out there that you project would be the ones that would close in exchange for opening these new areas, and that would be a concern of mine. I can, you know, I assume it's ones that are more rural and elsewhere in the state, but I just raise that concern, and I'd like to know if you're foreseeing that, or if you're looking at management changes. Are you bringing in more volunteer groups to help do some of the cleanup or improvements at these parks? I'm just, and I'd like to see more of that if it's going to be an either or choice.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, using your local park is a good example, actually. Glacial Lakes has an 80% manager now, where in the day when it was created, it had two managers. We now operate it under the administrative center of Lake Carlos. So a lot of the business activities occur at Lake Carlos, a lot of the supervision, the resource management assignments. Having said that, we are open spring, summer, and fall. We provide all of the services we have in the past, and we are attempting and I think successfully being more efficient at that. We did pick 18 parks and reduce spring and fall camping this winter, so there will be 18. Those were the least used campgrounds in the system, so we saved several tens of thousands of dollars basically in staff support and lost, I think it was $14,000 in revenue. So the net out of that was positive. We understand that these parks are important to these communities, and we hope to work in a variety of ways to successfully manage them, particularly during the busy parts of the year, so that we can provide that service that was there. Senator, I would not be candid if I didn't tell you there may be, as we move forward on this, some parks and recreation areas that are going to have some kind of very alternative management that might be sustained over time more as a wildlands area that would not provide many services. There may be other partnerships that we can come together with within DNR and among these local communities. To do that system assessment is the now our biggest task so that we're making the right decisions, but there will be some consequences to those.
Lastly, Mr. Chair, thank you for that answer. I think those are some of the outcomes I would rather hear. That sure, you found a way to reduce some staff costs, still keep the function of the park open, and collaborating with Lake Carlos, which is about 30 miles away. It makes sense that you could do have some synergies there. So I appreciate hearing that, and hopefully that's the direction they try to go, rather than just close parks, because that was at least at one point what there was an attempt to do. So.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Nelson, the report you talk about, this working group recommendation 40-40-20, it should be of interest to members that was a battle that went on the last go-around, and rural Minnesota being the 20%, 40% going to Metro Regional Parks and Trails, as well as 40% going to the DNR. I believe this last biennium, if I'm correct, that was a little different in that 38%, I think, was going to DNR. Yeah, you're shaking your head, yes, and 42% to Metro parks. So my, I guess my, where I'm going here, and members should be very aware that there's a lot of funding going into parks. And my question would be similar to what Senator Westrom is saying. We're ending up with a lot of parks. We have about 76 parks here in the state of Minnesota that are run by the state of Minnesota. We're also now acquiring and funding and managing some regional opportunities, regional parks, and that's going to grow. That's going to grow with the organization of rural Minnesota being fairly new to the funding source, the legacy money. So not as much of a question as a comment. Pretty soon we're going to have a lot of parks. We're going to have a lot of parks. We're going to have as many state parks as we have now currently, and we're going to have a ton of regional parks. So when we move forward, it really has to it seems to me very, very organized. The state parks, the ones that I visited, by the way, are run very well. They're very nice. I don't know how they'll compare to the regional parks, but soon we're going to have an awful lot of parks for the amount of people that we have. So is there a projection maybe for that comparison to other states? How do we sit? Maybe you have that in your flyer here. Are we I don't want to use the term parked out here in another 10 years, but it seems like we're going to be spending an awful lot on that. And is that need someplace, some study done where we're going to need all of those different experiences throughout the whole state?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, would you indulge me for just a moment if I could explain to the new members kind of the subtext for this larger question? When the Legacy Fund was passed, the commissioner, by law, was directed to create a 25-year plan for parks and trails in Minnesota, 25-year legacy plan. That included not only DNR, but Met Council and Greater Minnesota. So that is the reference point for the senator's question. Where are we going and how are we getting there and how are we going to measure that along the way? There is a committee appointed by the Met Council chair, the Greater Minnesota chair, who is now Al Leifert from Alexandria, and Commissioner Landwehr. And this group then oversees the application of this document as well as how it relates to the heart of your very question. So if you include trails in that whole question, Senator, then I would say we are working on that. We have currently not only in our system, the Met Council has a formula that they use for the distribution of their legacy dollars, and each of the members of the Met Council have their own long-range plans. Greater Minnesota is working on that. This body funded a study for Greater Minnesota to create their own future plan that then would match what we have done and what the Met Council has done. They're behind, and you're at some point we'll hear a presentation on that, I would imagine. But the goal then is to have this statewide picture of where we're going with parks, where we're going with trails, who should be running them, what's the deferred maintenance cost of building them. The best example I can give of all of this that might be illustrative to you is about trails. We have a very, very successful trail system in our state, both motorized and non-motorized. We win awards for this. It would be valuable if those trails met when the opportunities came about, if new trails were developed based on this kind of regional thinking that is behind somewhat the senator's question. It would be helpful to us if we could concentrate our energy on fewer state trails and then augment and support the regional trails as they move forward. A lot of big issues that this committee is working on that then plays out in some of our budget requests, Senator, and some of the conversations that I know you were involved in up around the Central Lakes area. So our effort is very much to be able to answer that question. We have most of the answers, but not all. And all of us, the three major units, have our own subset of issues, like how are we going to pay for the state parks that we have now, that become a part of that overall answer. Is that helpful, Senator, in some ways?
I think it is. If there's no time frame, I can't pressure you for that answer. It just would be nice to have a broad overview of the whole state and where we're putting our resources in. And we have a lot of state parks, and I think we're going to start seeing some rural regional parks. And when is the balance going to be? How much do we spend on one before something else? As Senator Sparks was asking, how many are going to, are we going to be dropping some and updating some others? So It's in the future. I get it.
You didn't want an answer to that, right?
No.
Okay. Senator Saxok.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Director Nelson, question, and if you're going to answer this later, you can tell me. But right now, most of our state parks are complementary to our resorts. In other words, you go stay at a resort, and it's one thing. If you're going to camp out, you may go to a state park, or state parks offer some amenities that, you know, that people at state resorts have. Now I'm wondering, in terms of amenities in the future, because I know there's more and more demands on parks and people that go to stay there. In the case of Vermilion, are we going to put some residential units there? And residential is a bad way of putting it, but you know what I mean.
Camper cabins.
That have a little more, yeah, cabins that have a few more amenities, and I'm worried. I just got to kind of put it out there, and would ask for your answer. Kind of is about how that is going to compete, or is it going to compete with resorts?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, in the specific of Lake Vermilion and our master planning activity, we involved greatly the resort community, and their basic request was, do what you do. Do not get into our world of restaurants and medium and high-end facilities. So we are hoping to build 8 camper cabins there, Senator. And these camper cabins are heated and they are lighted. There's no indoor plumbing. There's no food preparation area. There's no flat screen. They're bunk beds. They're very well built, and they'll be there for 30 years. But and there are differences of opinion on this, I will tell you. But that is what we aim at. Members are, we have about 5,000 campsites in the state, and only 1,000 of them have electricity. So again, in that private sector world of the Campground Owners Association, most of those have got water, sewer, power. Not all, but most. They have other amenities that we do not provide. And Senator, I do not see us moving into that world of amenities. That being said, we would like to have power at more of our campsites over time, because a lot of our users want to plug in electric devices and charge things and make interesting morning cups of brew that without that power gets to be pretty difficult. I will tell you, members, that we did meet with Dan McElroy and the Campground Owners Association in December, and they have brought up some concerns specifically about the camper cabins, and we are trying to find a resolution with them on that specific issue.
And Mr. Chair, that's what I would, the answer that I guess I would like to see is that if you're indeed coming up with a niche that isn't being fulfilled, either because supposedly there isn't, the resorters don't see the need or as much value in it, then I think it's fine. But I just do not see competition tax paying. Businesses.
I can't believe there's no flat screens. But anyway, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, just real quickly, we will be covering the legacy funds as it relates to parks and trails in this presentation.
Is there flat
I know
screens
that
in there?
You'll be talking about that separately as well as that legacy bill moves forward. So we can take questions now or have questions later on. I also just want to bring to your attention a report, and I'll send you the link to your committee that I think some of you have seen. It's called Destination Minnesota. A New Direction for Minnesota State Parks and Trails. It's the outgrowth of language in the last session's bill that required us to do a report on just what we got done talking about, what is the status of the park system, how should it be funded, and how do we move forward with long-term funding options and the state and the size of the system. So just in the essence of time, Mr. Chairman, we'll send you the link. If anybody wants a hard copy, we can certainly provide hard copies for the committee as well.
And you're right, Mr. Meyer. We will ask questions when we feel like it. So,
thank you.
What you're right about.
Mr. Chairman, Nelson. Members, this is our first change item, and this was a previously referred to a general fund increase recommended by the governor. And this addresses the day-to-day operations. I would add to your understanding of this, members, that this is mostly a state parks issue. It is not the trails issue or the other things. The state park system was built on general funds, and so it disproportionately, a loss of general funds disproportionately impacts our state parks and state recreation area system. If you look at that bottom bullet there, that's what I was referring to earlier in terms of some of the efficiencies that we have tried to achieve with our reduced spending, eliminating some managers, creating administrative centers, and the IT improvements that we have in the system. We also have done, as I also mentioned earlier, research with the University of Minnesota. So I think some of your senators have had questions about, do we know where our users come from and how long they're away from home and what kind of dollars they spend? And we do have that information, and I can share that with you at another time or offline. But this is the proposal to basically keep us level, supplanting, if you will, that one-time money that came in under the 12-13 budget.
So, Mr. Nelson, if there's 8 million visitors and we charge them each a quarter, would we raise the amount of money that we're looking at there from the general fund?
Mr. Chairman, this is one of the – yes. This is one of the rich arenas of discussion that always happens is when we talk about access and day use, what is our purpose? Are we trying to have a low hurdle to get as many people as possible into state parks? And basically that is what we have done in the past, $25 for an annual pass and $5 to get a car in. Or do we try and control more of our costs and increase our revenue by higher day use fees? We already have a fee system, Mr. Chairman, that charges camping at a variable level depending on where you're staying and what you're doing. One of many options is to increase fees, and one of those options is to increase the day use fee.
And this 2.25 million general fund increase is operations and customer service, correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
And which means what exactly?
Mr. Chairman, this would allow us to continue the basic operations that we have, the maintenance workers, the lady at the contact station paying our electrical bill, adding some modest maintenance when something falls into disrepair.
Is it an increase in FTEs?
Mr. Chairman, we do not plan on hiring more people with this. No. This would be to keep the people employed that we have doing, and principally this would be seasonal work, people that come on in the spring and work into the fall.
And how would you pay for it if you don't get this?
Well, Mr. Chairman, depending on the outcome, I suppose, of a number of factors, we may have to look at some combo platter of reduction in services and fee increases. This is one of those ongoing discussions that we have. And at this stage, we recently increased our camping fees a year ago. I know it's somewhat of a desire by the commissioner's office that we keep that hurdle low for day use so that we're getting people in at little or no cost. So that would be the conversation that we'd have to have, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the day use fee currently?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, it's $5 per vehicle, and it's $25 for an annual pass. And that annual pass is day of date, so for one calendar year, you get access to all of our state parks in the system.
Do you have it seems to me, I used to go to McCarthy Beach State Park, which is just north of where I live, and it seemed to me they had a day pass as well as a summertime pass that was just good for that park. Is that, do we still have those, or just it's good for all the parks now? Okay. All right.
Okay.
Continue.
Mr. Chairman, our next change item has to do with our reservation system, and some of you may know that we have a private sector vendor who does our reservation system for us. This is to create a fund so that we can pay them for their services. Previously, they received the money, and then they paid us our money, and with this last bid and this last contract, we turned that around so that we received the dollars, and then we pay them for the reservation work that they have done. This is zero-based budget on our side of this. We do not have expenditures in the reservation system.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the reservation system, where is that located? Is that located in Minnesota? So they'll know
Mr.
How to
Chairman,
pronounce
I'm sorry.
Bemidji?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the corporate offices, I believe, are in Long Island. There is a call center in the South Twin Cities that is an operations from our vendor that we required in our contract.
Long Island meaning?
New York.
Mr. Chairman, there are three companies that provide this service, basically, and they compete at all state levels for these contracts. Our particular vendor is in New York.
What's this Minneapolis connection?
Mr. Chairman, there's a call center in South Minneapolis where when people, rather than making their reservation online, they call the call center, and we required in our contract that there be a Minnesota-based call center.
Good. Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But the online activity would be referred to their facilities in New York for the online reservations then?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I don't know where their online resource center is. That could be in Indianapolis or in New Orleans. It's their corporate office is in Long Island.
So, Mr. Nelson, this is a $500,000 change item. How much do we pay for this service in total?
Mr. Chairman, we pay nothing. This is paid by the person making a reservation. And this is to set up a fund so that money can be held until we can pay the vendor for the services they have rendered in administrating the service.
Why?
It has to do with the natural resource accounts, and in order to pay somebody, we have to have an account that's set up specifically for that purpose, and we don't have that now. And so we are asking to have an account set up that as revenues grow from the reservation system, payments can be made to the vendor according to our contract for the service that they rendered to us and our customers.
Well, how do we do it now?
Mr. Chairman, now we have the reverse. The vendor receives all of the money, and then they pay us for a portion of our work. This turns that around so that we are holding the money and with our bank here in Minnesota, and we are paying them for the revenues that they have made.
Why don't we just become the vendor?
Mr. Chairman, it would be cost prohibitive at a rate that I could not recommend.
Why?
Mr. Chairman, setting up a call center and an IT network to go with it would cost, from my experiences when I was a director in Utah, twice the revenue that we would make under any conditions. You've got all of the HR issues, all of the updating of the online work, the expenses of cost per square foot per month for operation, the updating of all the equipment. We have none of those costs now. It's all in the private sector. We get the service, and I'm pleased to say I cannot remember the last time I got a complaint about our electronic reservation system.
And so why do we have to have our vendor from New York, though?
Mr. Chairman, we put this out for public bid, and we would hope that there would be emerging companies in the Twin Cities that would have wanted to build it. I believe this comes under the category of scale and scope. If a vendor has already successfully got 15 or 20 state park systems and part of the National Park Service and big county parks and golf courses and people who do concert tickets, that it is an efficiency for them to add another source of revenue, and the bigger ones just get bigger. And when we look at the quality of the service, the online services to the person making a reservation, we end up supporting those contract bidders that have the best product. And our requirement was that they have a Minnesota-based call center, so we had Minnesota people answering the phone and answering those questions. But the business element is really spread across the country in these three or four vendors who do this work.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know, Mr. Nelson, what the total revenues are for this business and then what they're remitting back to the state currently?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the cost per reservation is $850, and we make, or the company makes, 70,000 or 80,000 reservations a year.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I can get those specific numbers for you at another time.
I'm just trying to get a feel for what percentage of the, you know, so it's $16 or whatever it is for the camping fee, and then they charge $8.50 for doing the reservation?
Mr. Chairman, that's true.
And they do 800,000 of them or so.
Okay. Any other questions on this?
Mr. Chairman, members, another change item. This has to do with one of our natural resource accounts, which is a cross-country ski account. And we require, as do several of our partners, that you have a cross-country ski tag. It's a 3-year tag, and it allows you to use the cross-country trails as part of this statewide program. We are asking for some dollars from this account to go to our state park system. We currently don't receive those dollars in our state park system and would like a small amount of those dollars so that we could do more of the grooming from the state park's cross-country account.
Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Director Nelson, where are we getting this $75,000? It's in the account, but is it going to be done at the expense of the grant and aid program, or how are we going to do this?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, we do not receive any of these dollars now. The account has grown, and so we feel it's fair that we get some of these dollars for our own cross-country skiing. I do not believe that any of the other grant and aid recipients will have any kind of a loss in dollars. We are spending money, Senator, from other general fund accounts to do this work now. We're just asking to create this for ourselves.
So, Mr. Chair, the account, because of people skiing, has grown. So that's what you're telling me. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nelson, is there an administrative cost going to occur on this account?
Mr. Chairman, there would not be.
And, Mr. Nelson, do people pay a fee to cross-country ski in our state?
Mr. Chairman, I couldn't hear you.
Do people pay a fee to cross-country ski in our state parks?
Mr. Chairman, they do.
Right. Okay.
Okay. And another change item is from our environmental trust accounts we have had, or I'm sorry, from the lottery in lieu account, which is another subset of the natural resource accounts. We are recommending a couple $100,000 grant program for local and regional trail grants. And this is a modest attempt to try and put more money out for local trail projects. The need is overwhelming. It's just an effort on our part where there's some dollars in the lottery in lieu account that could only be spent in this area to add to our grant program.
And Mr. Nelson, this could be, you have bicycles on the trail, but this could be a snowmobile trail, or it could be a ATV trail, or it could be anyone.
Mr. Chairman, that's true with the grants. And almost in all cases, the asphalt trails that we have in our system in the winter almost always are snowmobile trails. Some of them are cross-country trails for cross-country skiing.
Okay. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you put any priority on these trail projects when they connect up with a state park?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, we do. There's three priorities for that: connecting two trails, connecting a trail in a community, or connecting a trail in a park. And you get bonus points. This, by the way, is a 25% matching grant program. Anticipating one of your questions, we have all kinds of grant programs. Some of them don't require a match. Most of them do. This one has a 25% local match. Okay. Here is our short presentation on our legacy dollars. This pie chart hopefully gives you a basic understanding of how we apply the legacy dollars that we receive. Back to the legacy plan, there are four pillars in that legacy plan: taking care of what we have, connecting people with the out of doors, acquiring land and creating opportunities and coordinating among partners. And so we have organized our dollars in that same manner. There are some things I would like to point out for you. You can see in the red piece of pie there, there is a light line between that. And we added that because the question is coming up all the time about how much of this money do you recommend go into acquisition. And the background for that has many inferences, but when folks voted in 08 to pass the legacy fund, there was some inherent quality of life benefit if they voted for it. A part of that in our world, as well as in Lessard Sams, was acquiring land. And so we are establishing what we think is a benchmark for what that level of acquisition would be. There have been two major acquisitions to date. One was we participated with other funding sources in purchasing LaSalle, and we participated with other funding sources in purchasing the Browns Creek Trail, which will go from Gateway into Stillwater. So those are the only two examples that we have of acquisition dollars that have been come from legacy funds. Some of your members and advocates that may be here in the room today feel that 20% is way too low. Others feel that 20% is way too high. And so this is our effort to have dialogue and find a landing zone where we feel that it is both meaningful to us and beneficial to us to have legacy acquisitions, and we have some criteria for those. But at the same time, to do the other things that I will show you here in the next few slides that we want to get done. You can see under each of those major categories, we've got some descriptors of what we think are indicative of the best of what we have done with our legacy dollars, whether it's rehabbing our facilities. You can see several examples of those, or connecting people to the out-of-doors, as have a couple of my predecessors mentioned. We in DNR have a very compelling responsibility to get more people out of doors and connect them in a way that they become lifelong outdoor activists, whether it's fishing or cross-country skiing or going to some kind of an outdoor event.
Senator Sacks,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Nelson, Senator Scoy talked about connecting, you know, parks, communities, other groups of public lands. When we're talking about these Parks and Trails legacy funds, are we giving thoughts to permanent easements? You know, I know that more and more snowmobile trails and ATV trails in particular, motorized trails, are having problems in that they can have hundreds of miles of trails and they can get screwed up by just 100 yards where they can't get the easement. And a lot of it is because you can't get a permanent easement. Have we given some thought to these permanent easements?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, we have. And as you open the door to this for your members to understand, particularly in the snowmobile program, we have 22,000 miles of snowmobile trails in the state, and many of those are across wetlands, they're across lakes, they're across edge properties. Where in the winter, we can easily get those easements. In the summer, most of those landowners, Senator, do not want to deal with easements. They're for their own set of reasons, that has not been a very successful tool in the toolbox for us. We bring it up, and we would certainly work with landowners should they want to go the conservation easement route. But as a a tool that we have been able to apply broadly, it has not been a very successful tool. I do not know about the grants end of this for those regional trail providers, if they are able to do more with conservation easements than we have. They might have had more success.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nelson, along the line of what Senator Saxog was talking about, are there any abandoned rail grades that you would consider purchasing, or any other, as opposed to, if you can't get the easements, is there any way you can buy some of those parcels?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, we're always anxious to get those because it's dealing with one owner that gets you from A to B is preferable to any other kind of situation. Senator, there are a number of them available, but they tend to be in areas where there's some realism that in the future there may be an active rail line there, and so they are hesitant, particularly in the northeast right now, where, as we all know, mining is going to be heating up, and so there's not any interest in those rail authorities of turning those over. The Browns Creek connection that I referred to twice, that was a rail line, and that we purchased that from the previous owner. Those in other parts of the state are, we're aware of them. Many of them, particularly in the farming country, has, I don't know how this works, but that land actually is being used as farmland. And so you've got to go back and work owner through these farm fields in order to reestablish that rail line. To your point, Senator, it's always preferable if we can. They tend to be in pretty places and off highways and that type of thing. I think the easy ones are done.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Nelson, can you give us a little bit of an update of, I see you say support Parks and Trail Legacy Advisory Committee. Can you give us a little bit of a background as to why the funding was taken from the Metro Regional, which are state parks, with 41 million visitors, and put it instead onto the state, which has 9 million visitors? Can you tell us a little bit of that discussion and how that worked?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I'm covering 8 meetings and 9 committee members, not one of which was me, in their deliberations. Basically, they arrived at a solution based on close-to-home recreation and tourism. And there's a formula that was agreed to by this group. We actually thought this was going to be a very difficult effort. This is the document that was created and that the chairman referred to earlier. And in that work, statistics varied from group to group, standards varied from group to group, and they were not able to reach an accord, and so they used a fairly simple formula based on close-to-home recreation and tourism, both in the metro area and in greater Minnesota, to make that recommendation for the 2020 split. I would recommend, Mr. Chairman, that it might be as this issue moves forward, that helpful to have some of those members who would come speak with you about their personal stories in this 9-member group. Each of the 3 entities had 3 members on it, and this was professionally facilitated. In terms of our interest in it, the commissioner stated that he wanted us to have something that we could recommend to the governor that would serve the greatest needs for the greatest number of people. Somewhere north of 40% of our state park visitors come from the metro area. Similarly, we have 50% of our visitors travel 60 miles away from home, so we're in that tourism travel world. Those aren't always the same statistics that regional parks use, and certainly aren't the same statistics that the Met Council uses. So we had different descriptors of the same problem and opportunity. The agreement that was reached in here was an accord based on good intentions and the best for the citizens of Minnesota.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. So will we have a presentation from that group? Because I don't have that document, and I'm wondering what the discussion was and if we'll have them come forward.
Maybe you should have a couple of those people come to your office first and talk to them and then let me know what you think.
But, Mr. Chair, I think we set the budget in this committee.
I know.
Not in my office. So.
No, but the suggestion was from Mr. Nelson to talk to a few of those people, and I don't really have any desire to do that, but maybe we will. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Nelson, could you talk to me just a little bit about some of the differences between the state park funding capabilities and the Metro Regional Park and ownership?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the Met Council has agreements with, I want to say, 11 government entities. They have a formula that they use based on activities and population as to how they distribute those dollars. Requests for legacy funds come from, say, Anoka County, and Anoka County knows they are going to get X number of dollars, and they say this is what we're going to do with them. And in some kind of a decision-making process in the Met Council, then that recommendation moves forward. There are 56,000 acres that are in the Met Council in terms of acreage. We have 260,000. It's the inverse, as the senator mentioned, in terms of visitation. We have many less millions of visitors at state parks. Our visitors stay much longer. Our visitors are there overnight. The Met Council has their own formulas that they use, and that's what Greater Minnesota is trying to figure out, is how do they measure these various things, and whose measurement tools do they use? And we're trying to help them out with that.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Nelson, do these regional parks, whether they're in Greater Minnesota or the metropolitan area, do they access county levy dollars, or are there other funds that they have access to that the state park system would not?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I'm not quite sure I know how to answer that. Maybe most simply, you are my only bank. The other system providers, I assume, use a baker's dozen of dollars that they get. I live in Washington County, and I know we have a very successful county system in Washington County, and there's a county-driven legacy fund, and I assume they have visitor revenues, and they probably have some county support. So I would think in each situation it's different based on where do those dollars come from. That would be my guess.
Okay. Keep going. We can keep continuing to explore this later on. We should probably get going so we can get the other people up to the table talking, and then get the other groups up here too.
I would be anxious to help with that, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Mr.
This is the grants component, and these are the dollars that go through us to Greater Minnesota. We do not receive any of the proceeds from this. We simply are grant administrators, and as you can see in the bottom part there, we handed out $7.5 million in 13 that went to 13 parks and trails projects around the state, and some numbers that go along with those. It is split 50-50 between parks and trails, and we just took that arbitrary decision several years ago. We get a bunch of applicants in both of them. The parks tends to be more acquisition. The trails tend to be more development. And then finally, the coordination among partners. This is a part of the legacy proposal, and this is to, as you can see from the language there, to help us coordinate our activities statewide level to implement the legacy plan that I've referred to do some social science research, to get good data, and to move the agenda along for all concerned. I believe that's it, Mr. Chairman.
Any final questions, Mr. Nelson? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, members.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Now we'll move into Fish and Wildlife with Director Ed Bogus. And the governor's recommendations in this division are unlike any other division, whereby we're asking for access to the game and fish revenue dollars that were actually increased last session with the raising of the game and fish revenues. Those dollars will be starting to come in into the system this March. So this proposal is asking for allocation or appropriation of those revenues. Also, as we spoke of earlier, the last bit of remaining general fund within this division, approximately $199,000, is in the governor's budget to be reallocated to other priorities within the department. So when we talk about the bar charts here in a couple slides, that general fund box will no longer be represented within the Game and Fish Division. So, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, I'm Ed Bogust, Director of the Division of Fish and Wildlife, and I'll try to quickly walk you through an overview. Our division has several focus areas. Habitat for fish and wildlife is a major focus, both terrestrial and aquatic habitat management and improvement. We also manage fish and wildlife populations on a sustainable basis, set regulations, and try to manage those populations in balance with other land uses and conflicts and so forth. We provide high-quality and abundant fishing, hunting, trapping, and other fish and wildlife-related recreational opportunities, and we have programs to try to maintain participation in those healthful outdoor activities. And finally, we work collaboratively with a lot of partners across the state on various projects and programs. We also reach out to the citizens of Minnesota to help provide educational information about fish and wildlife management and appreciation. Similar bar chart to what you've seen from the other divisions. As Mr. Meyer mentioned, there's a vanishing blue bar at the bottom of this chart that you can see, which represents the general fund in our division. It's essentially gone. There is some pass-through general fund for treaty payments. That's that red bar, the next red bar at the bottom of the graph. The part of our budget that I wanted to just call attention to, I think certainly the members that have been around here for a while are aware, but for the new members, our division operates almost exclusively now off the Game and Fish Fund. The Game and Fish Fund is the green bar in the middle, the tall bar in this, and that's derived from hunting and fishing license fees. Certainly want to extend appreciation to the legislature and all the organizations representing people and individuals who buy hunting and fishing licenses for the fee increase that passed a year ago and that takes effect actually later this week on March 1st. So we'll be talking about asking you to help provide some of those dollars to do some more work. There were no appropriations associated with those increased fees. So, and this is what we call the foundation of our fish and wildlife budget is the Game and Fish Fund. Some of the bars at the top there represent some of the smaller miscellaneous dollars that we get, whether it's special revenues. We've gotten a little bit of federal dollars, but we get very little of that. It's usually for a specific purpose like disease monitoring, or we did get some for a walk-in access program for a couple of years. And then with the new legacy dollars, we do get some outdoor heritage fund for project-related work and some clean water fund for biological monitoring using fish populations to monitor water quality. But the bulk of our budget, about 85%, is Game and Fish Fund. The governor's budget proposal for the coming biennium includes some change items that I'll talk about in more details. This slide highlights specifically the Fish and Wildlife Division portion of the Game and Fish Fund change item. Governor's proposing a $6 million increase over the biennium. For the entire Game and Fish Fund for the department that I'll talk about later, it would be $8 million for the biennium. There's also the $400,000, roughly it's $398,000. The last remaining general fund in our budget is proposed to be cut. And then there's a critical habitat license plate. I'm sure people have seen the critical habitat plates with the loon or the deer or the lady slipper. The people who buy those plates contribute into the critical habitat matching account, and we're going to be asking for the first increase in the cost of those plates since they were started 20 years ago. And I'll talk about that some more later as well. The Game and Fish change item, as I mentioned, this is a department level $4 million a year. Change item that we're requesting that would capture some of the revenue from the new fees that are taking effect on March 1st, which is the start of a license year. For most of our hunting and fishing licenses, the license year runs from March through February. So when the new fees were passed last year, they had a delayed effective date of March 1st of this year with the new license year, so that everyone buying a license within that license year would be paying the same fee for the same license. We're proposing to use these dollars for accelerated management of our wildlife management area system.
Before you go further,
yes, Mr. Chairman.
Is this $4 million? This is an increase, and it's coming from the fees, right? From last
year. Mr. Chairman, that's correct. It would be a $4 million increase out of the Game and Fish Fund.
And is it sustainable into the future?
Mr. Chair, yes, it is sustainable into the future. The for those that were around last year, you might recall the Game and Fish Fund was headed towards insolvency. We had been, you know, as usually happens, we had last gotten a fee increase in 2001. And for a number of years after a fee increase, there's dollars that are banked because we know inflation will eat away the buying power of those costs. So we had been banking money in the early 2000s. By the late 2000s, or 2010, I should say, we were spending more than we were bringing into the Game and Fish Fund. So the new revenues, once we're into a full fiscal year, which would be fiscal year 14, are projected to generate about $10.7 million a year. We're asking for $4 million of that in this initiative. The difference makes up for that declining balance that we were experiencing a year ago just to maintain the solvency of the Game and Fish Fund. Other things that would be funded with this would be additional assessment of waterfowl and migratory birds, enhanced implementation of the Prairie Plan, which is a priority of the department, and we would be putting more of these Game and Fish dollars to working on prairie projects. On the fishery side, we'd be looking at accelerated surveys of both fish populations and of anglers, and also fish health and aquatic habitat management. We'd like to use a little bit of this to do more outreach and recruitment of hunters and anglers and providing better information to citizens on fish and wildlife. Enhancement of game and fish law education and compliance, the compliance portion of this. Some of this money would go to our Division of Enforcement and then inventory analysis and monitoring for restoration and management efforts. There's a small amount of this that would also go to our Ecological and Water Resources Division.
Mr. Chair. Senator Skoy. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Baugus, I didn't, conspicuous by the absence there of any EIS discussion, why is not some of this game and fish management money going into aquatic invasive species? It seems to me that if you don't figure that out, be much fish management necessary.
Mr. Chair and Senator Skoy, we are working very closely with our Ecological and Water Resources Division, which is the lead division for the AIS program. Our fishery staff are, particularly on the Asian carp issue, very active in the monitoring and design of barriers and those sorts of efforts. We have not devoted hunting and fishing license dollars specifically for AIS directly. It's been through other charges, you know, that are levied that program's been funded. So your observation is correct that we have not slated any of this new hunting and fishing license money to an AIS initiative.
Mr. Chair, and, you know, maybe as we go through the session, that ought to be part of the discussion that we have. I mean, do you know why the fishery in Mille Lacs is collapsing? Is it related to zebra mussels, or what's going on there? Maybe this needs to be discussed a little further, and some of these dollars should be going there.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Meyer just reminded me there is a surcharge on non-resident fishing licenses for the AIS program, so there is a direct charge, at least for the non-residents, for AIS work right now.
Well, I think Senator Skoy's concern is that the money that you have coming in right now isn't being used for it. Is that correct, Senator Skoy?
Well, Mr. Chair, I just think that the department needs to be more. It seems to me that there's a lack of emphasis on this aquatic invasives at the department level, and I am really concerned about it. You know, we've got the zebra mussel now in Winnie, and if fisher people are going to do their morning fish on Winnie and the wind's going to come up and they're going to take their boats to some smaller surrounding lake where the wind isn't blowing. I mean, this thing potentially could really it's spreading. We haven't stopped it. It's an abject failure of ours to have not done that. But it's really going to take off, and I just think that we should be putting more money into it. And if there's $4 million, and I'm looking down the accelerated management of WMAs and additional waterfall population assessment and enhanced implementation of Prairie Plan, I just think that those are all second-tier priorities compared to the control of the aquatic invasive.
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, thank you very much for that concern, because we have that as well. And funding drives our mission, as you well know. These dollars are for the management of game and fish populations paid for by the people who are participating in those sports. There's another layer that we have to talk about, the federal requirements that we have in managing these dollars for the federal dollars we receive. So we'd have to be very careful that we're not put in a diversionary situation, spending these dollars on AIS at the federal level, putting into damage or the funding status of those federal dollars at risk. We do need to talk about AIS and how do you pay for it at the watercraft level. Right now you pay $1.33 per year, $5 every 3 years when you register your boat, no matter if it's a $10 boat or a $100,000 boat. So we need to make sure that we're putting those fees in the right areas. And we do agree with you that probably aren't spending enough resources on this, but we need to figure out what those resources should be and how they should be allocated. So we look forward to having that discussion with
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Myers and Commissioner Landwehr, when he was here last week, he said that the AIS account is actually going to have $500,000 less dollars this year than last year. I mean, the good news is that it is permanent money instead of one-time money, but it's less resources, not more. I'm astounded.
And I think your point is that maybe our priorities need to change in the Game and Fish Fund, too. Mr. Rogers, go ahead. Oh, Senator Dietzick, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to echo what Senator Scoy was saying. It is a big issue in greater Minnesota, and that is directly tied to the economy up there, the tourism economy. But it's also a huge issue in actually Senator Dibble's district with the chain of lakes, and then Lake Minnetonka is one of our bigger lakes down here. And I know they're very worried about zebra mussels and whatever other mussels they have out there that are, I don't know if it's quadrant mussels, if they have them. It's a huge issue, and it's a tax issue, and that's a huge recreational area here in the metro. So this is a state problem that I think we do need to deal with and put the adequate resources.
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Meyer maybe, or whoever, while we're on this topic, can you give me and the committee an update on research and dealing with some, I'm forgetting the name of it now, up in Alexandria, you did a study last, or you're starting to work on a study. I know I've talked to you multiple times in the past about just different eradication potentials, at least research that's going on, needs to go on, and I think you've been doing some at Lake Carlos. Can you give us an update on that? And the name of the product will come to my mind here as a
Zequinox.
Mr. There you go.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrom, yes, and it is that Zequinox research that we are continuing to look at. It has been proving very promising, so to speak, within a controlled environment such as pipes for utility infrastructure or things like that. The challenge gets to be when you're spreading it or applying it on the lakeshore bottom where it cannot be contained in specific concentrations in an enclosed environment. So we're working on that. But to go back to something that we talked about with the Eco Waters budget, one of the things we are proposing to eliminate with that reduction in funding from last biennium to this biennium would be our research activities and coordinate instead jointly with the AIS Research Institute at the University of Minnesota, concentrating our efforts at that level. So they will be continuing on with the Zequinox research. And if that funding proposal moves forward at those levels, we will be participating, focusing all of our aquatic invasive species research with the university at the research center.
Chair, probably not needed for the committee, but I wouldn't mind if you have more detailed update that you come by and give me that. And if it's something for the committee, if you let us know, and the chairman know, I'd just be more interested in what are they actually finding on that study, or haven't they got to the point where they've been able to do enough in the water to find effective or not effective methods?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrom, we will make sure that you are updated on that research and also CC the committee members as well.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Myers, this is getting a little off subject, but as long as we're talking about aquatic invasives and control mechanisms, is the DNR contemplating perhaps going down the path that has been used in the past on a couple of or maybe a number of lakes where they would actually just do a control mechanism on the lake, even if it did damage some of the natural species, and then try to do a restoration of that lake? Is the DNR contemplating anything along that line where you'd actually go in and eliminate these pests from the lake and then try to restore it, or is that not being contemplated?
Mr. Chairman, Mayor. Senator Skoy, we've been working with, in conjunction with the Corps of Engineers and several other research institutes at whole bay treatments on Lake Minnetonka, but eradication of all the vegetation in one water body would have severe water quality and fish population habitat impact. So we haven't looked at kind of the nuclear option yet, but we're trying to figure out how can we most effectively deal with these species and not have the huge impacts that we're concerned about.
Senator Skoy.
And this will be my last question, Mr. Chair. Yeah, Mr. Myers, is the department considering any recommendations to the legislature with regard to closing some of the accesses? I know a number of these lakes have multiple access points. I know we've had discussions that it's hard to monitor all these varied access points. And is the department considering maybe trying to focus the access points down to where they're easier to monitor?
Mr. Mayor. Mr. Chairman, Senator Skoy, that's an ongoing discussion within local communities. We own only half of the water accesses on any water body. You look at the number of accesses on Lake Minnetonka, for example. We own a handful. There are hundreds of private ones there. So we're trying to work with local units of government to make sure that we're educating and enforcing and monitoring and cleaning boats in a effective manner as possible.
I'm sorry. I have to have one more. But aren't those...
We've established in this committee that the last question is not always the last question.
That's right. But what is the... Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Myers, what's the permit process that a landowner would have to go through to develop a lake access? Don't they have to be permitted by the department?
Mr. Chair, Senator Skoy, I don't believe we would permit that. A lot of that would be dealt with at the local level and the local shoreland ordinances. I'll have to follow up on that question with you.
Senator Osmek, you heard the word Minnetonka, and then all of a sudden you woke up. What is that? Is that what happened there?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I was relaxing today. I was hoping that I wasn't going to have to say much, but to Senator Skoy's point, there are many, 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 many access points on Lake Minnetonka that are completely uncontrolled. They're owned by the cities, and some of them are private, that they put in their own private in and out ramps in their own backyards. So to your point, controlling Lake Minnetonka is you can control the major access points, but you won't be able to stop, and that's probably how we've got to the point we're at. We weren't able to stop people putting in water toys, putting in a brand new boat lift that they brought over from a different lake that was infested. That's probably one of the likely ways that we got zebra mussels, and that eradication, to the testifier and to Mr. Chair, eradication is the only way to go about dealing with the situation. And we have actually done private partnerships with private and government partnerships and dealing with some of those bays I've been involved in, having some of our local money go into those, and they've been very effective at controlling the invasive, which is Eurasian water milfoil. But then people complain about the fact that the natives' weeds come in, and they say, well, wait a second, the milfoil's gone, but now we got these other weeds. What are we going to do about that? And we say, those are the native weeds that you should expect to see. So there's a lot of difficulty in controlling large bodies of water, maybe easier for smaller ones, but for Lake Minnetonka, it's the only way you can deal with this is eradication.
Well, Mr. Chair, that's exactly my point, that I think the department needs to start researching and analyzing recommendations or methods to do exactly that control. It's not going to be popular, but it might be successful. And I don't know what percentage of our lakes currently have some form of aquatic invasive, but hopefully it's under half. But, you know, if we don't do something, pretty soon it'll be 50%, and then it'll be 70%, and then it won't matter anymore. And, you know, we can wait and talk about this again next year, and then, we, you know, it'll be Winnie and Leach or who knows what. I think we should be having a very serious discussion this session about methods to combat the spread of AIS. And if it means we close some access on some lakes, so be it.
Thank you. Mr. Bogus, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, this is another change item. It's a little bit related to the discussion that you've just been having in that it does deal with control of aquatic plants and we have split this program now where the invasive aquatic plants are managed by our Ecological and Water Resources Division, and we've eliminated fees for the invasive permits for bay-wide or lake-wide treatments of invasive species. The primary emphasis of this program is on lakeshore owner control of native aquatic plants that have value as aquatic habitat, but that also can interfere with recreational access. So we've been previously mandated to adjust permit inspection fees to more fully cover the costs of this program. It's currently about $1 million a year in program costs. The fees that we're proposing in this initiative would get us up to about 70% of the cost of the program, and it would allow us to continue to allow lakeshore owners to recreationally access their lakes, but also provide protection for native aquatic habitat. And part of the reason this doesn't generate the amount of revenue that would be needed to fully cover the cost is just because we're no longer charging for those invasive species aquatic plant permits.
Mr. Bogus, how do we collect this fee? I see it's $35 now. You want to go to $90? Boy, I got some friends who live on the lake with me that when you raise something $5, they go ballistic. So how are you collecting this fee, and when is it charged?
Mr. Chair, control of aquatic plants requires permits from the department. So when they submit their application for a permit, they have to also submit their fee.
Okay, so if they want to take care of something that's in their on their lakeshore, for example,
right?
They have to apply for a permit and then.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Okay. If they want to clear a channel, or if they want to through emergent vegetation, or if they want to clear a swimming area of aquatic vegetation, they have to get a permit to do that.
Okay.
The next change item is critical habitat license plates. These were established in.
Let me go back one more. What if we didn't raise that fee? Just out of curiosity, what would the effect be?
Mr. Chair, this is a program that we're currently subsidizing with Game and Fish dollars. So. We aren't adding any new permitting or any new inspections
I'm told it's Water Rec now.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, that's correct. It's Water Rec account money where these fees get deposited, but they're not paying for the full cost. So the part we're subsidizing is with Game and Fish dollars or in EcoWaters. I'm not sure.
Well, what do you subsidize? Because the people are just doing the work themselves once they get the fee, right?
Mr. Chair, this is the cost of our staff doing the inspections, doing the delineations, issuing the permits, not doing the actual control work. So because the fees in the Water Rec account do not cover the full cost of the program, they cover about a fourth of the cost of the program, we're still running the program. This would just get us users paying more for the program rather than the Game and Fish Fund paying for the program.
Senator Ingebretsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm following up on your point here, Mr. Bogus, could you take us through the workings of an inspector coming out to a licensed or permitted residence on the lake, as you talk about here? How exactly does that come about? And how many of those, I guess, how many of those do you have a year, and how many inspections do you do?
Mr. Chair, we issue about 4,000 of these permits per year. I don't know that I have at my fingertips how many of those involve an on-site inspection. We do have aquatic plant specialists in our area fisheries offices who issue these permits and who go out, look at the property or look at the, you know, photo of the property and identify what type of aquatic vegetation is there and what square footage would make the most sense for the property and for the what the property owner is trying to do and yet protect the aquatic habitat to the extent that we can. So it's a process where the lakeshore owner applies. Our staff go out and consult with them on the control. If it's aquatic invasives, that's in eco waters. They actually go out and do a delineation of the extent of the infestation in the area that's proposed to be controlled. So it's a fairly intensive process to figure out what the control area is going to be and how the operators can be licensed to do that control. So it varies on the type of plants. There's permits for just the regular plant control for recreational purposes. There's permits for swimmer's itch or algae control. So there's a variety of types of permits that are issued under this program.
Just real quickly, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have participated in the getting a permit for the swimmer itch. But my question is, and I don't want you to play your hand here, but how do you 4,000 permits, how do you randomly enforce that? How do you go out and check to make sure they're not doing permitted for 300 square feet and they're not doing 600? Do you just randomly do that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebretsen, well, we have the inspection method to do some of that, but we can't go out and look at them all or follow up on them all. We do also have an enforcement division that can look at them, and Colonel Conrad may be able to offer more insight on that. But it's a program where they do have a permit. We can detect the removal of aquatic vegetation pretty easily. So, you know, it is something that is enforceable as we go forward.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bogus, so if a shore landowner has a weed roller or something and they're doing, you know, aquatic plant control, and they go in one year and do their application and put their weed roller in or whatever, and do they have the renewal in the next year, or do they have to get another new license the next year, and how does this fee interact with those ongoing kind of operations?
Mr. Chair and Senator Skoy, some types of permits, like a channel permit through emergent vegetation, there's a one-time inspection, and as long as they're just keeping that same channel in the same location, then it's an ongoing permit. I am not positive on the mechanical weed roller or other mechanical permits, if there's an annual inspection involved with those or not. I'd have to check on that and get back to you.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Boggs, would there also then be a $90 fee that would be that? My question is, do they pay the $90 every year, or do they pay it every 5 years, or what? How does that work?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scarry, on the channel fee or the channel permit, where it's a multi-year permit, there's just one fee. On the mechanical control, I believe it's an annual fee for that.
Go ahead, Senator.
Huh? Osmek, Senator Osmek, you want to
go ahead?
Yep. Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, so the fee applies, the $9 fee applies to regardless of the project area. I mean, on Lake Minnetonka, we have one big bay we do, so we would assume that we would pay a $90 fee. Meanwhile, a single homeowner would pay a single. There's no linear footage. There's no project area complement or a component to how that fee is applied.
Mr. Bob.
Mr. Chair and Senator, it's for the bay-wide, I assume you're talking Eurasian milfoil or
right.
One of those types of treatments, and there's no charge for those. That's one of the differences that we've initiated over the last few years is if it's a permit to control an invasive species, kind of the feedback we were getting from people was, we're trying to do a service here. Why are you charging us a permit fee to do a service? So that made logical sense. So we've waived the fee for the invasive bay-wide or lake-wide permits. But otherwise, yes, it's per property. And there was, I should point out, there was a cap of, for some of these, of $2,500 per lake if there were multiple properties, but we're proposing to do away with that cap as well. So it would just be a standard fee per property.
Okay. Finish her up, I guess.
All right. I have one more change item, and that's the critical habitat license plate donation. These plates, since the mid-1990s, people would pay an initial $40 fee, $10 for the plate, and then $30 annual fee for critical habitat. And it's been a very popular program. These have been, we've added some different plate designs. These have been, I think, the most popular specialty plates that Department of Vehicle Services has ever issued. But the cost of these has not increased in 20 years. The proceeds from these plates goes into what we call the Reinvest in Minnesota, or REM, Critical Habitat Matching Account to match donations of cash or land. It also, these dollars can be used to match donations to the Non-Game Wildlife Fund that people can contribute to either directly or on their state income tax form. So there's currently about 108,000 of these plates out there, and we'd be proposing to add $10. I have noted on this initiative, since we put it together last fall, there's few discrepancies in the amount of money we would expect to raise and the amount of money that we have to match. But we always have a backlog of donations that we're unable to match until we can get more money. We've gotten bonding money into the Critical Habitat Match program in the past for land donations. We've gotten Environment Natural Resource Trust money into the Critical Habitat account in the past to match donations. We've got the license plate stream of revenue, but we still have a large number of unmatched donations that are in the queue that this would help us to address.
Senator Ingebrigts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're asking for $10 per plate. Now, when you did your study, or did you come up with the number here, did you take into consideration some are just going to say, I'm not going to do it anymore, and figure in that loss? I'm sure you did.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigts, and that's certainly something that we would expect there could be some of that. We don't have a good way of estimating how much that might be. We do know there's kind of high fidelity to these plates. Once people get them, they tend to keep them. So we're hoping that will be minimal, but we don't really know for sure. And, you know, we're saying here $1.3 million in revenue. The latest plate numbers are about $108,000. So if we didn't lose any, it'd be $1.08 million. So it's the revenues are probably projected a little bit high. We put this together several months ago, and we also don't know what drop off we'd get from the increased price. So
thank you. Okay. Any other questions, Mr. Boggs? Thank you very much. Appreciate
Mr.
it.
Mr. Chairman, members, we'll bring up Colonel Jim Conrad to try to wrap this up for you in a quick manner. He's our Director of Division of Enforcement.
Members, it's my intent to finish the agenda today, so we got a couple more departments that will be coming forward. I think we can stay in this room until 3 o'clock because nobody needs the room after this, so if we have to go over time, we will, but we'll get this done. So, Colonel, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Jim Conrad, Director of Enforcement, and just a little bit of background on me. I am the director of our oldest division. We celebrated 125 years in the state just last year, and I'm also the smallest of the directors. So.
Uh-huh. And the most popular.
How did you get to be the oldest? And didn't we have to do this before we enforced it?
I wish I was the oldest. Unfortunately, there's a couple a little bit older than me.
No, but I mean, you said the division's 125 years, and how did we get enforcement before we had problems?
Quite frankly, enforcement was the birth of the Department of Natural Resources in 1887. It began with the appointment of the first state game warden.
There you go. Okay.
Just to give you a little scope of what enforcement does, obviously the word is kind of self-explanatory, but we do enforce laws, but along with that we also have an educational component. We are the providers of the safety training programs for firearms, for ATV, for snowmobile, and off-road vehicles. And we will be assuming the role of taking over the educational boating safety program as well in the very near future here. Our scope is basically game and fish and recreational enforcement, outdoor recreational enforcement, both motorized and non-motorized. Another big component of our job, as peace officers in the state of Minnesota, we provide public safety, and we also provide response to natural disasters such as the Red River Valley floods, weather-related disasters like the flooding and rainstorms that we had in the Northeast this year. Those are all general fund supported activities. We also provide search and rescue and response to other law enforcement agencies in time of need. If we go to this next one, this shows the expenditures historically. As you can see, the big green section in the middle is the Game and Fish Fund. That's our primary funding source, which amounts to anywhere from 65% to 70% of our annual funding. The dark blue section above that is the Natural Resource Fund, which is divided into snowmobile, ATV, off-road vehicle, those sort of activities. At the very bottom is our general fund. As you can see, there are a few blips in that over the years, but it has been a general fund decline in the past few years. One of the things I'd like to point out is that those dollars are extremely important to us for a couple of reasons. They fund our environmental enforcement piece, such as AIS, water quality, air quality, that sort of thing, but also all of our public safety activities are funded by the general fund. We can't dip into those other dedicated funds in order to provide that. In time of need, that provides us with some difficulties in some of those big flood years where we put a great effort into assisting those local agencies, especially the Red River Valley, which seems to be the perennial issue. We have to dip into those general fund monies at the expense of some of our other environmental enforcement activities. You'll see also there some water rec fund and federal fund monies. At the very top, those federal fund monies, I think that's the orange. You can see some variation in that. What that amounts to, we have some federal funding for specific programs such as border security and harbor security grants and some of those others. Those are a very small part. Where you see the expansion of that orange area are generally fire years where we assist not only fire within the state, but we also provide services to federal fire disasters in other states as well and get reimbursed federally for those activities.
So
So how much did we get out of that $22 million fire that was up in the Boundary Waters?
Mr. Chair, I can't tell you exactly, but we do get reimbursed for all of our time and equipment expenditures for those. The only problem there is that it generally takes us a little while to get that reimbursement. You're looking at maybe a 6 to 9 month delay in the reimbursement of those funds, and if it happens in the second, late in the second year of a biennium, you know, we can't recover those in that same biennium. This is the governor's recommendation for enforcement, and basically what you see there is a $1.9 million increase in the Game and Fish Fund. $1.7 million of that is just basically recovering the activities that we have seen eroded over the years by the increased costs in providing services. It would allow us to restore several of the vacant positions that we've been holding open for many years to provide for those services. And then an additional $200,000 out of that $1.9 million would be, we'll talk about that in the change item that's coming up in the next slide. That would be for an initiative to allow us to provide for some specialized hiring for protected class to bring our division more into line with the changing demographics of the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman, just quickly, these dollars that are on this slide come out of the $4 million we just talked about with Game and Fish Fund or the Fish and Wildlife Division, and also the $1.2 would be directly related to the $3.75 million appropriation general fund in the Eco Waters Division. So these are not additive to those other proposals. These are where the dollars would be allocated to those activities. Just a point of clarification.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quickly, the amount of sales tax that's generated from hunting and fishing opportunities, and that's a federal program. Can you, maybe you talked about that already. Does Enforcement Division get any of that money? Pittman Robertson
in the wall, parole dollars. Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, yes, those dollars do go into the Game and Fish Fund, and then they are distributed back to Fish and Wildlife and Enforcement.
Maybe you can just give us a little idea as to where that is, how it's grown, or is it increased or decreased over the years?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I don't have the specific numbers in front of me, but because of people buying a lot of firearms and ammunition, those the Pittman Robertson dollars have grown dramatically. So we can get you those balances and where the historical timelines and charts on those. So
I would like that. Thanks.
Colonel?
Mr. Chair, the other portion of that is the $1.2 million increase in general fund, which replaces some environmental trust fund one-time money in the past biennium to allow us to continue our efforts towards aquatic invasive species enforcement. And just to give you an example of the increases that our division has seen in those efforts, in calendar year 11, we had 5,500 hours devoted to the aquatic invasive species enforcement check stations and that kind of stuff. Last year, we bumped that up to 17,700 hours. We saw an increase also in decrease in violation rates based on that effort, dropping from 18% overall to 14% overall.
Senator Stackson.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. Colonel Conrad, just from those statistics, I'm assuming that you'd think that you're putting somewhat of a dent in the enforcement of aquatic species. I mean, is it you don't your force doesn't believe that it's an undoable thing to keep boats from going in with invasive species on them, or
Mr. Chair, Senator, obviously nothing's foolproof.
Yeah.
We as enforcement, we feel quite strongly that increased enforcement efforts will reinforce the activities of boaters so that they are more likely to comply. One of the interesting things that we saw with the advent of check stations last year, those are just random areas where we would pull boaters over and inspect them rather than at access sites where they were getting the expectation of, you know, all the boaters expected to be checked when they went to an access site. But on those areas where they were just driving along and we pulled them over, we saw very, very different violation rates. In the check stations, we saw as high as 50% violation rates as opposed to the 14% that we saw at public accesses. So there's an effort definitely that still needs to be done in changing the behavior of the boating public to where they're doing it whether they expect to be checked or not.
Okay, hey, Colonel. Thank you.
We have one change item here, and that's a conservation officer pre-employment education program. And what this is, we struggle as well as all the other law enforcement agencies to bring protected class into our workforce. We have 26 protected people out of the 188 officers that we have out there, which is certainly not representative of the population in general, and puts us at a disadvantage in reaching some of those groups out there. This is a very small investment that I think will pay off very well. It would allow us to go out and recruit individuals, protected class individuals that have perhaps current college degrees, but don't have the ability to take another 2 years out of their life and go back to school for a law enforcement degree. This would allow us to put them through an intensive bit of training through the community college system to get them those law enforcement credentials and then put them through one of our regular conservation officer academies and get those selected individuals into the field in a more expeditious and selective way.
Colonel, isn't this happening already?
Mr. Chair, we are working very hard to try to get protected class candidates through our process. We don't have this process. State Patrol and some of the larger community police departments like Minneapolis and St. Paul are doing this. This is basically modeled after their efforts. But we don't have this this ability at this time.
And can it be part of your $71 million? Or do you have to have new money?
Mr. Chair, basically, in order to provide for some of these, you know, extra costs, our only alternative currently is to hold stations open in order to provide for those monies. So basically, it costs us positions in order to do these sort of programs.
Senator Saxon.
And Mr. Chair and Colonel Conrad, you were sharing with me after a number of years of decrease in the enforcement force that within the last year you had two academies and there was you have a net gain of officers now in the last 12 months?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's correct. We started out last year with about 30 vacancies. We had two academies in the past two fiscal years that amounted to 20. Out of there, we had 17 officers that we managed to get through that training successfully. And unfortunately, in the meantime, we had an additional 10 retirements. So our net gain was 7. Once again, it's kind of a revolving door because of the length of process it takes us to get a person hired and then trained and then basically put into the field.
And Colonel, have you had the pleasure to work with Representative Cornish in your distinguished career?
Mr. Chair, yes, absolutely. In fact, he can probably tell you a story or two about me, and likewise, I could do the same for him.
Okay, we'll keep that off the tape. Okay. Any further questions of the Colonel? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Cornish was up.
Who's next? Board of Water? No. Oh, Dolly. No. Department of Labor and Industry, please.
Good
pressure on you, Commissioner, to work the computer here. Can you do that? Or?
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Ken Peterson. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry, and I'm completely technologically ignorant. We're not going to use any slides like that.
We aren't going to use it? We have it in our packet.
Well, you have your packet. So you have your packet.
We have the slideshow in our packet that we're not going to see. Is that your computer there?
No, it's yours. It's property of the Minnesota State Senate.
Okay, just close it then. If it's not going to work, then we're not going to use it. Okay. All right.
You've been sitting here quite a while. I'll try to make this as brief as possible, but yet fill you in how the department works.
We got an hour.
How our funding works, and to talk about our change items.
Okay.
The Department of Labor and Industry basically deals with two broad areas. One,
Commissioner, can you put the microphone closer? There you go. Okay.
Two broad areas. Is that right? Is that okay? We deal with two broad areas. First is workplace safety. That's workers' comp and OSHA. And our operations there are paid out of assessments on individuals' workers' comp fees, and as well as OSHA, we get half funded by the federal government. And then our other broad area is in construction licensing. We license and permit construction occupations such as electricians, plumbers, that sort of thing. We also do plan reviews. We do building codes, approve building and plumbing permits, and enforce actions too. We also have a third smaller area is our apprenticeship and labor standards, which the labor standards is the only part of our whole budget that's funded out of the general fund. That's about $1.5 million. We'll go through the details of that. And then we have apprenticeship, which is funded out of workforce development funds. The construction stuff is all funded out of the out of fees, which I'll talk about. I think we do a pretty good job. The department's done a pretty good job of being very aware of the fact that we're not funded out of general funds and that we do have a certain amount of, I don't want to say leeway, because we come back to you when we talk about raising fees or reducing fees. At the same time, I think we do have a responsibility to control our costs as much as possible. Over time, the workers' comp area that under my predecessors and myself, we reduced the numbers from 2002 to now has been reduced by 30% from 175 employees to 124 employees. So I think we've done a good job there trying to use technology as good as possible and not have excess people. Another area we're doing right now, we do a lot of, is Kaizen events. Basically, a Kaizen event is you get the people involved in a given area, and you sit them down, you spend a day or two or three trying to make them work better. They talk about their problems, how they can overcome any obstacles, increase efficiencies. We've had 15 last year, 3 so far this year, and 13 more coming up this year. Every one of those is making us more efficient and we think doing a better job for the public. And that way, trying to keep us from having to hire more people, to have to invest where we don't have to. And finally, you may have noticed in last Friday's Pioneer Press, one lead story was the governor was pointing out efficiencies we had saved. The first sentence had to do with pointing out that the construction licenses for electricians, for plumbers, and for others had been reduced in time. It reduced 65% of the time to get one. That means if you're trying to get one 15 days now, you can get one about 6 days. So we've reduced that a lot, and we're very proud of that. So we do fees assessments, and we understand that at times you may not be as concerned with them, particularly near the end of the session. We also understand that people pay those fees, they pay those assessments, and we want to keep those costs down as low as we can. So I think we're doing a pretty good job of that. The department is a regulatory agency. That's what we do. Almost every part of what we do, except for apprenticeship, is in the regulatory area. I want to take you to page 5. Looks at our funds, where we come from. That's this page here with the pie chart. You can see the largest single area is workers' comp. That's $189 million for the biennium. A lot of that comes from insurance benefits, workers' comp benefits that were done away with in the 1995 legislative session, but we're still paying for those benefits which were incurred before that time. Those second injury funds and supplemental benefits are called. That for supplemental benefits, $100 million, and second injury benefits is $21 million. Those costs will decrease over time as, I suppose, around sometime around 2040 or so, there'll no longer be any costs. No one will be alive who will have incurred those benefits. We also, out of that fund, we pay for bankrupt and uninsured employers, and that's around $19 million. Then the operations of the Workers' Comp Division of OSHA and for the Office of Administrative Hearings and the Workers' Comp Court of Appeals also comes out of that. Then the next largest section is construction codes and licensing. Those are the revenues come from inspection fees and permit fees. And that's, as you can see, is $50 million for the biennium. The next largest area is a special revenue. And these are kind of odd ones that we're not, a lot of them are passed through. One's a contractor recovery fund. If your contractor doesn't do a good job and you can't get any money out of them by a suit, you come to that and we pay you up to $75,000 to pay for the contractor who may have cheated you one way or another. But that's funded by assessments voted by on the contractors, which they wanted to do themselves. So they're covering their own industry. But we're administering for them. Another area there is a log safe program, which we assess mills, sawmills, and paper mills, which goes on to pay for safety training for loggers, and management has done a good job of keeping the cost of loggers down. And the next area is federal money. That's, as you can see, is $10 million. That's from OSHA. And we are going to be hit a small amount by the sequestration that's coming up, presumably coming up on Friday, that we're losing around $250,000. That we're going to be very fortunate in that area, though, that we've planned well. We have some vacancies, and so we won't be laying anybody off. So it shouldn't affect our operations. And we'll be cutting some out of state training travel, too. Then the general fund is less than 1%, and that covers labor standards, which does child labor, minimum wage, non-payment of wages, and prevailing wage. The last one's called other.
Commissioner, to that point, over the years we've dealt with the enforcement of prevailing wage, and it always came back to us that we don't have enough personnel in that area to do a really good job of enforcing it. And I heard your comment earlier that we have reduced our complement by 125 people. Is there a necessity to get more people into the prevailing wage area for compliance and enforcement?
Mr. Chairman, members, the reductions I talked about were in the workers' comp section, were not in the prevailing wage section. I don't think you can always use more people. There's no question about that. Same time, I think we can do the job right now with the people we have. I think we're doing a good job. We've got a lot of cooperation from the other agencies. If we needed somebody, we'd ask for them. Okay. But I'm not going to say, if you offer me people, I'd take them. But nevertheless, we're not asking for it.
Well, we need your guidance on that one.
I understand. Okay. Yeah. The other is workforce development. We get $872,000 a year to operate an apprenticeship program from DEED. And the combative sports. Last year, the legislature gave us the Combative Sports Commission, which is funded by fees about the tune of about $124,000. I'll be talking a little more about that when we get into changes to be made or change requests. And the next page is just points out that most of our the lesson of that page is to point out that much of the money that comes into the Department of Labor Industry is for external purposes, not for operations. I don't think we need to go in that in a lot of detail, except you can see that our total operations, say across the top line, is the total operations is $50 million, but the external costs are $92 million. So that's where they go out in benefits and other areas. That's where our money really goes to, in things like the Log Safe program, other smaller ones. Well, maybe I should go through very brief to point out some of the things we do, though. The Vinland grant is a small grant that goes to a rehabilitation institute in western Hennepin County in Loretto that they charge us for they can charge us up to $200,000 a year. They get very hard to retrain and hard to rehabilitate injured workers, and they can charge up to $200,000.
You know, that almost seems like that should be a winery, Vinland, you know, but I guess it's not.
Mr. Chairman, I've been working very hard to convert to a winery, and you will certainly be the first person to know about it.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, can you stop real quickly and talk to me just briefly about this combative sports industry and what it's costing the state of Minnesota? And I try and not watch it, but it certainly catches my eye on TV. And can you tell me what kind of a player, if you will, that the state of Minnesota is in regulating that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, and members, our budget's around. We're given. I'll give you a little bit of background. We regulate two areas. Something called mixed martial arts, which is a more recent one that you'll see a lot on TV, and boxing. So there's two different areas. We regulate amateur and professional mixed martial arts, and we regulate professional boxing. Prior to July of 2012, it was an independent agency, and they were having a lot of financial problems. And so it was given the legislature's Sunset Commission last year gave it to us, and so we took over management of it on July 1st. We ensure the safety of in every fight. We license everybody. The fight that there was sadly enough in East Grand Forks last week, there was a man who died from a fight, but he was in amateur boxing, which is regulated by a different body than us. It was a tragic thing. Very fortunately, we haven't had one like that. However, it's completely funded by fees upon people like the promoters, the fighters, the referees, the ring announcers, the judges, those people, and we will be asking for a fee increase. That's one of our fee change requests we do have. We have a range of attendance at fights. I was at one a few weeks ago that had around 4,000 or 5,000. More typical, you'll have 200 or 300 people attending one. Attending a fight. So some of those things were making money, and others were losing quite a bit in terms of just the operations. However, at every one, we have a doctor. There's pretty skilled doctors. We have pretty well-trained referees. One of the boxing referees is considered one of the top 10 referees in the world, and he flies all around and handles fights, championship fights across the world. I think we have a pretty good group of people working on this. At the same time, I realize there's a lot of negative feelings towards combative sports of all kinds.
But bottom line is they're paying for themselves.
They're paying for themselves.
Good, thank you.
There's no general funds money going into it. Going on, you'll see the Workers' Comp Claim Service Investigation Benefit Units, Benefit Claims for Injured Workers. I talked about that. Then the other state agencies we fund, Workers' Comp Court of Appeals, OEH. And then we also give $700,000 out of Workers' Comp assessments paid out. Your insurance goes for fraud investigations to the Department of Commerce, and then Minnesota Management Budget gets $100,000 for overhead. The OSHA Workplace Safety Consultation, we have safety grants that we give out every year to up to $10,000 for people to improve their workplace safety. Typically, it goes to nursing homes, hospitals that may want a new lift to help people. As you probably all know, it's one of the most working in nursing homes has become one of the most dangerous occupations in the state in terms of bad backs and other things. Construction codes and licensing, we have a contract recovery fund, which I mentioned, but also one I want to point out now is the contract electrical inspectors. What we do here is we have about 10 electrical inspectors who work full-time for the state. Then we have 76 people who work on a contract basis. And some of those people also work, do some private work, but by and large, they make their living under a contract from us. So we pay them. The advantage for the state is when there's a construction downturn, as we had a couple years ago, we don't have to keep those people unemployed. They take a risk. There's no construction, no electrical work in their territory. They don't get paid. And so we think it works pretty well. that in terms of it handles the ups and downs of the construction economy. So we think it's probably a pretty good system. And then we also give $100,000 a year for what's called LEAP, and those are for minority training for in construction trades. But that's just a rough – that's a quick overview of just where our money – where we get our money and where it comes from. Mr. Chairman, I don't want to spend a lot of time. Do you want to get, we could go right to our change agents, or we could go to page 8 and quickly show you one more time where our, how the money is spent on a biennial basis. It's another pie chart. Just I've said this same thing several other ways, but you can see the workers' comp benefits, 53%, accounts for 53% of our total budget. And then workers' comp and OSHA, 18% of our budget. That's the blue. And then the construction codes and licensing, 21%. And that's, once again, I want to emphasize, that's all paid by fees. And the trick with fees, with any kind of a fee system, a license fee system, is just you're not taking in too much, but at the same time, you're getting enough. So it's constantly evaluating the flows of money, how it looks like, looking all the time, and make sure you have a little bit extra, but not too much extra.
And I think you've worked pretty successfully with the industry in establishing them, too, and everybody's kind of on board with what you've been doing over the years, from what I've been able to see, at least.
Mr. Chairman, I think we have to. As I'll discuss when we get to the change areas, they've all been done in conjunction with the regulated industries themselves. And got their opinions and got their feelings. We don't want to get in a fight with them. We want to do something that works for the industry but yet provides for public safety. We can go right. I don't think we need to look at the various things we do. Instead, we can go right to the change.
I want you to do that, but I'm just going to tell the members this. Take a look at this handout that the commissioner is working off of, and if you go through it and see any questions that you have, he's going to go to the change items right now and discuss the change items. But if there's anything within the handout that you have any questions about, go ahead and ask. But for now, I'll let the commissioner go to the change items.
One thing I want to point out before we go, though, if you can go to page 10, that's OSHA compliance. You see a trench there on the bottom. And you see the individual down there. This is one of the most common things we have in OSHA. It seems every year we lose a few people. You can see this trench is ready to cave in. Mm-hmm. That it doesn't have one of those boxes to protect them. And you got an individual way down there, and you can see that the thing is not wide enough. It looks like it's about 4 or 5 feet wide, and it should be 10, 12, 15 feet wide. And so they were fine in that one. But every year we'd lose a few people. They're mostly from smaller operations than I think this one is. But they're always a very sad thing when trench caves in on somebody. It's just a very sad thing. And it's one of the great things OSHA does, that they do stop and check these things out. This one was just a random stop where a guy pulled up and walked out and then took a photograph and then went and told the guy to get out of the trench. And we're glad of it. And we saved a life that day.
Tell him to get out of the trench? No, yep. He apparently took the photograph before he took it.
Yeah, he did. He took a photograph and then he said, get out. The good thing it didn't fall in while he was taking the photograph. Let's go on to the change pages, Mr. Chairman. And I may be calling on Jessica Luman, our assistant commissioner, to help me out on some of these. But the first one is, that's on page 20. This is out of the governor's proposed budget. As you can see, the first one is labor standards and apprenticeship, the child labor initiative. We had, 2 years ago, we had a terrible thing where a 17-year-old kid was working in, I think it was in Duluth, was working in night on refueling an airplane, and he didn't know what he was doing. He hadn't been well-trained, and he suffocated to death. And what our concern is that a lot of young people, for those of you who were young at one point or have had children, sometimes their brains aren't working quite as well as we'd like them to be. At least my kids never did. Anyway, what we want to do is do a special outreach to reach out to employers and schools, employers of young people, and to emphasize them the importance of safety on the job, of taking care of themselves, of you know following the best safety procedures. This would be mostly in retail and in restaurants, but there are some other areas too where people, like this young man in Duluth, that are working. We want to get reach out to them and let them know that safety is important, and don't be macho. Don't be don't let your testosterone run too quickly. Just be careful. And so we want to do an outreach program on this. This would necessitate hiring one extra person and try to head off this 100 children. Like it points out there, 100 children each year suffer, about 100 children each year suffer work injuries. We want to stop that. But that's for that's the only general fund request we have is for the $300,000 for the biennium. The next one is the rest of ours are fee adjustments. And the first one is the Office of Combative Sports. And this goes along with Senator Ingebrigtsen's earlier question. And the Combative Sports Commission simply did not have enough money to do what they were doing. And they're running in the red. And so what we're trying to do is raise the fees on fighters, on their managers, on their trainers, what they call corner people, promoters, and others to make the office self-sustaining. And this would be a total of $88,000 increase. It's a wide number. I might go through the individual ones, but for purposes right now, I think we want to raise those fees to these people. And we have a combative sports advisory committee that has looked at this. They've looked at it at two different meetings. We've talked to a lot of people in the business. And every one of them agrees that we need more money to operate, to provide safe cards for people. And if they have to pay for it, they're willing to pay. The next one we have is an elevator. The next three, basically relate to fairness in assessing these fees, to make sure that the causes of the cost are paying for the appropriate level. And that's what we're trying to do. The first one is an elevator inspection fee adjustment, and this would simply establish a more equitable inspection fee schedule by removing the current cap on inspection fees. Right now, we charge 0.015% of the value of the elevator being inspected up to a cap of $1,000 on a facility. So that is, if you're putting in if you're putting in the more expensive, if you're putting in lots of elevators, you're getting a good deal. And if you're putting in only a few elevators, you're subsidizing the people putting in a lot of elevators. And so you're subsidizing, say, office buildings, hotels, large hospitals, and if you're only a small business or a nursing home or something like that, there's only one or two elevators. In effect, you're subsidizing the big guys right now. So what this would do is simply remove the $1,000 cap so everybody pays the value of the elevator.
Commissioner, the way I understood it was that if you have tall buildings, you're going to pay. If you don't, you're not going to pay.
Right, right.
So us people in rural Minnesota that don't have things over three stories, we're okay. And the Tonka people should worry.
But I guess there was a lot of talk about a new 85-story building in Chisholm. Is that correct?
Yeah.
That's a library.
I didn't tell anybody about that yet. How did you know?
The words in the street.
Okay.
Words in the street. Anyway, that's what we're trying to do there. The next one is the plumbing inspection fee restructuring. This is another one we've talked with the industry on this. And this would be... we do about 1,700 plumbing inspections annually. These are mostly for public licensed buildings or public buildings, not for just regular buildings. And what the proposed change replace the current fee structure with a permit fee of $100 and a fee of $25 per fixture and eliminate the current $1,800 cap. Right now, we charge the fees based on something called the drainage fixture cost. Drainage fixture unit, which combines several, like your sink and your toilet may be part of it. What we want to do instead is just charge on the fixture itself. So people can never understand what they're exactly paying for, and then we'd remove the cap, which is $1,800. The chief beneficiaries of this, once again, are smaller buildings, and the bigger units would be paying more for it. That's just another one.
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, is this the program that applies to buildings over a certain size or certain number of drains? And
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrom, it applies to publicly licensed buildings like, say, nursing homes or schools, or nursing homes or hospitals, or public buildings, like a new county seat. It apply to that. But it would not apply to a private building that's just being put up.
That's a different program?
Yeah.
That,
is that my
right? Like a new apartment building or a new...
No, would not affect
cafe
that.
Cafe or...
No, those are covered by the city of, usually by the cities that they're located in.
Oh, I see. Okay.
The next one the plumbing plan review. Right now, we do plan reviews on publicly licensed buildings and publicly funded buildings. We call a Lexus fee. That is, if you pay extra, you go to the front of the line. And if you don't pay extra, you go to the back of the line. What we'd like to do is you're guaranteed, if you pay extra, you're guaranteed to get your plan reviewed within 15 days. What I'd like to do is just do away with this entirely and just guarantee we do the plans within 15 days. I don't think government shouldn't be in the business of trying to offer to do this up for bidding, because some people don't even know about the Lexus or they refuse to pay for it, and they end up, it can take them 3 to 4 to 5 weeks to get their plan reviewed. Well, others will get theirs done in 3 weeks. I want everybody to be done in 3 weeks. We're just going to guarantee people getting done in 3 weeks.
They're just going to make everybody pay the double fee?
No, they're going to pay a lesser fee.
Okay.
So we're losing money in this one. We're losing $600,000.
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, this is actually the one I was, you got to it. What is the requirement to do this? What plumbing plan review, and what do you charge for it? Is it like $200 or $400 if you do the Lexus plan?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrom, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to ask Jessica Luman, who's the assistant commissioner for that area, to discuss it in a little more detail.
Ms. Luman.
Mr. Chairman, Senator,
just say your name for the record.
Jessica Luman, Assistant Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry. The plumbing plan reviews are required for commercial facilities where our authority to do the plan review hasn't already been delegated to a local authority. So we perform about 2,000 to a maximum of about 3,000 of these plumbing plan reviews a year. And they are required to be performed prior to the construction, prior to being permitted to do the construction. So we actually review the plans that are engineered, and then a permit is allowed to be issued.
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, what size buildings does this apply to, and where's the requirement? Is that a federal requirement or a state law? Ask the second part of this question. It's always perplexing because you've already got Minnesota licensed plumbers that you're having to do this plan review on. Why license them in the first place if you've got to have another layer of bureaucracy to review the plans that the plumbers are going to implement?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, this is a state requirement that the plumbing plans be reviewed, and it is for all commercial installations. So it is not residential. But it is anything that is classified as commercial under the building code. To your second point, this is something that the industry, we really worked with the industry on, because a lot of times it is licensed plumbing professionals who are doing the installation. But when the problem is identified at installation or in the inspection phase, it's often extremely expensive to bring the installation back into code. So the state has determined that if we do the plumbing plan reviews early in the process, that we can avoid a lot of costs later.
So Mr. Chair, how long has Minnesota done these plumbing plan reviews? And second to that, I think you might want to check your residential aspect, because I know at least small apartment building owners, one that is in my district that was subject to this not very long ago.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I'll definitely check on that. Again, typically if it's it falls outside of the residential if you get to four stories or more, even if it's an apartment building. But let me double check that for you and get back to you on that. The first part of the question, we think that again, this issue started at the Department of Health and was transferred to the Department of Labor and Industry in 2006. It's our understanding that the plumbing plan review requirement began sometime in the 70s.
Okay. Lastly, Mr. Chairman, we talk about losing $600,000. Is this an area we could consider getting rid of, as long as a licensed plumber is involved in the plan to begin with? Or is this something that could be delegated? And is it delegated in any other local jurisdiction?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, this authority is delegated in some jurisdictions. We delegate inspection authority on both the plumbing plan review as well as the building plan review, as well as building inspection for state licensed and owned facilities where appropriate. We do delegate that to local authorities where appropriate. Commissioner, do you want to answer the second part of that question, the first part?
Well, just maybe before you answer that, Mr. Commissioner, on that point, the 2,000 to 3,000 reviews you do is in addition to. Is there lots of local entities that are delegated, or is it just a few? Give me a context of 2,000 to 3,000 at the state. Then there must be a bunch more locally.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrum, the larger cities have certainly delegated it. We don't have a list in front of us, but we'll certainly get that to you and give you a better sense of that, whether or not we should take steps to delegate more of them. We're certainly more than open to delegating more of these things. We do what the legislature wants in these issues, and which leads me to the next question, and what the industry wants. The industry has said that it's good to have, they want licensed plumbers, people that know what they're doing when they do the work. At the same time, they don't want to do a building and then have a building inspector come in and say, you put the pipe in the wrong place, you got to tear the building down. That's why they like to have someone look at the plans in advance. They simply don't want to have to redo it twice. And on this and other areas, that in the construction area, most of these are arrived from the industry looking for a way to save money to make their operations just do it more carefully. There obviously are some people in the industry who don't like it, but it seems to us the majority have supported this and continue to. But we're certainly open to however you want to deal with it.
Well, Mr. Chair, and just Commissioner, I wouldn't say it's all across the industry. I have dealt with some very mad and frustrated business owners, theater-involved people that have tried to remodel one bathroom and all of a sudden had their facility closed for weeks and months because of this plan review issue. I'm wondering if there's ever a level where maybe we don't need to apply the same to a one-bathroom or two-bathroom remodel of a theater the same as a four- or eight-story building in Minneapolis, and maybe to save the money we could find a some sort of threshold. Not all my plumbers are overjoyed about this idea, and on smaller remodels or smaller buildings, it seems like it would be it's overkill and it's a delay that wouldn't need to go on. And so I'd like to talk to you about
that
further.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrum, we're open to it. We'll set up an appointment with your office.
All right, thanks.
The last one we have is actually a small change, but one that could affect a large wind facility somewhat. Right now, when we inspect wind turbines at wind farms.
Commissioner, can I just stop you for a second? We're running out of time for Board of Water and Soil Resources. So we're going to, I'm sorry, you guys. I know you've sat here and you were really, really interested in everything we talked about, but we're not going to be able to get to you today. So I think, does Monday work for you guys if we come back next Monday?
Sure.
Okay, and I apologize for that. This took longer than I expected, but we had some very interesting discussions today, I thought. And so,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
So, no, you keep going. We're just
oh,
talking to those guys
oh,
back
I
there.
Oh, I thought we
could not
answer.
Nice try,
Howard.
I want you to keep talking. But I just want them to know that they can leave if they want, because I'm not going to call them up here to testify today. But I apologize for the delay. So go ahead, Commissioner. Keep going.
We just have one small item. That's the wind turbines. And with this right now, wind turbines are basically you put a bunch of turbines out in an area. They're all built the same. Each one's used the same electrical wiring, same setup. And right now we go and look at, under the law, we have to look at each one of those closely and inspect each one. What we would do instead is provide an alternative approach where you'd simply submit your plans to us, we'd take a look at it, inspect one of them, and then do a light inspection of the rest of them. And this would save the developers a lot of money, and we think that provides the same sort of safety for everybody. And I think this would only affect, it would only really help someone doing a large wind insulation. And I don't know if there, we don't even know if there are any planned right now, but over the next 5 or 10 years, there certainly will be more, there should be some larger ones coming online. It would save somebody some money. I don't want to exaggerate the importance of this. It probably could save somebody upward $25,000 to $50,000. Still it costs us millions. Same time, we think we can do just as good a job and provide the public safety that you need to have.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, most recently there was something in the news, and you probably can't comment on it. Maybe I'm out of line to even ask, but there was an Attorney General's office has intervened and taken over some action about some windmill that either damaged or was not working. Maybe it's a company that was selling a bad one. Are you involved in anything like that at all?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, no, we're not. But I think that was a problem of the manufacturer.
That's
was
right.
Putting the, there's something wrong. I think there's something wrong with the blades, if I'm not mistaken. And they were causing problems on the farm.
It's a product thing.
Yeah, it's a product
okay.
thing. So we don't have anything to do with that. We're just concerned about wiring it correctly.
Okay. Anything else we need to know, Commissioner, today? But I see you have a real lot of smart people over here, so do you need any of them to come up and talk?
They're passing me notes all the time.
They are.
Yeah. So I think we've covered everything, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Senator Weber, you have a question? Interested in something here.
I'm fine.
All right. Anything else that we should know? Okay. I guess if that's it, then I thank you for coming in. Has your bill been introduced yet? Or?
No, it hasn't.
Not in the Senate.
Not in the Senate.
Do we have the language in a bill form?
The language being done is done now, so we should get it introduced soon.
Okay. All right. Senator Weber would probably love to author it for you.
Okay, we'll talk to him.
He said he wanted to take it home and read it tonight. Did you?
Yeah. Another Senator Weber here.
I got it covered.
Okay. Maybe Senator Westrum would like to take it home.
He does.
Okay. If there's no further questions or comments, I thank you all for your patience. And there was a very good hearing, I thought. And we will, we're doing bonding bills on. So go ahead. Tell us what we're doing on Wednesday.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Senator, Sandy,
Senators, we have 8 bills dealing with bonding on Wednesday's meeting.
And this could be something that we'll be doing quite a bit of in the very near future, because we have something like 100 bonding requests that have come through this committee. So there could be, we'll be trying to cherry pick them to see which ones are ready, if we can get an indication from the authors of whether or not the bonding requests that we're getting are actually ready to be done this year, because oftentimes we get some communities that are forward-thinking and they have some bonding requests that may not be ready for this spring, and maybe ready for next spring. And so, if we can possibly get authors telling us when they think their projects will be ready, that'll make it easier on us to choose projects that we may potentially recommend to the bonding committee in the very near future. So, do you have something there to tell us? No. Okay. So, Senator Engelbrecht.
Just a point of clarification. So all the bonding bills are coming here, and we refer them to where? To the bonding committee then?
We don't get all the bonding bills, but we get the ones that have something to do with this committee coming
through.
Environment
or commerce.
Yeah. And, okay. And economic development. All right. And maybe, I don't know if there's any ag bonding bills or not, but then what will ultimately happen is we'll hear them here and then make a recommendation to the bonding capital bonding committee, specifically what we think is ready to go and what should be included in the bill. And then they will actually go through the recommendations coming from the divisions and put together a proposed bonding bill, and then I think we'll either propose or dispose of projects in that particular committee.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, I believe our recommendations go to the full finance committee, and then they pass it on from there.
I don't think it works that way.
Are we going to take individual votes, Mr. Chair, on each and every one of them?
I doubt it. We'll lay them over for possible recommendation to the bonding committee. And I don't think there will be an official bill coming out of this committee as a bonding committee going. If it were an official bill, then it would go to the finance committee and then be recommended. Right. But I think what we'll be probably doing, and what we've done in the past at least, is that we've actually written a letter and said we recommend these particular bills be included in the bonding bill. So, but the official hearing status is here. And then potentially in the past, we've actually, since this is the off year, that the bonding bill probably isn't going to be that big this year, but even though I'd like to see a $1 billion one, we have then actually gone from project to project over the summertime to actually see them, because I found it's very, very valuable to figure out what it is these people want to do by actually seeing what they have on the ground there. And so I would assume we'll be having bonding tours starting in in the summertime, I would assume.
Are you on that committee, Mr. Chair?
Yes, I am. Yeah. Yeah. Are you?
No, I'm not. Mr. Senator next to me. Yes.
Okay, all right. So, having said all that, thank you all for your attendance today and for sticking around and listening to these very, very interesting agencies.
Get our full admission.
And the meeting is adjourned.